Tonight, we consider the Star of Bethlehem, one of the most endearing and yet mysterious aspects of the Christmas story. And I say mysterious because it is only mentioned in one of the four New Testament Gospels, the Gospel of Matthew. And even there, it occupies a mere 8 verses, providing tantalizingly few clues as to its nature. That has not stopped people from speculating on what it might have been. And those speculations accelerated with the dawn of modern astronomy, when Galileo, in the early 17th century, for the first time, turned a telescope to the heavens. And since then, as we've begun to understand the nature and the contents of the universe, of the cosmos, there's been an ever-increasing number of people that have tried to associate the Star of Bethlehem with various naturalistic phenomena. We're going to look at several of those theories tonight and measure them against the biblical and historical evidence and see which, if any of them, really hold up. And that will be our project for the night. I'll give my conclusions at the end. So let's begin by looking at the relevant biblical and historical evidence. Here are those few 8 verses from the second chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the reign of King Herod, magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. From these few verses, we can extract 9 or 10 clues. Let's take a look at the first one. Is this little phrase here, "We saw his star"? Now, if you look at an interlinear Greek New Testament, that phrase is right here, for those of you that have studied Koine Greek. The word for this translated star is right here. In Greek, it's the noun astera, which is it's a first declension noun. It's the nominative case singular person. And that's a very critical point, because we're talking here about one star, astera, singular, not plural. We'll come back to that later this evening. What is that? It's an English derivative of the Greek word for star, an asterisk. Can you think of any other English derivatives of asterism? Disaster. The ancient concept of maladies being associated with signs in the heavens. And so disaster, disastrous. But the little key on your computer keyboard or typewriter with the little star, every time you touch that, I want you to think of the Greek word aster that we find in Matthew chapter 2. So the first clue is that there was a star, singular. The second clue is this: magi from the east came to Jerusalem. So the second clue is that magi traveled to Jerusalem. And here are some works of art depicting the adoration of the infant Christ by the magi. This is a sculpture in the cathedral at Chartres in France, dating back to the early 16th century. And here are some famous Renaissance paintings and medieval paintings, each one of which depicting the Star of Bethlehem in different ways. Now, so that clue indicates that the Magi came to Judea or Jerusalem. Why would that have been? And it's interesting that there was an expectation in that day, not just in Judea, but outside of Judea, to the east in what was called Mesopotamia in those days, of a king being born in Judea. Let's look at a few of the secular historians that comment on this. The first is the first century and early second century Roman historian Suetonius. His most famous work, in fact, the only work that survives, is De Vita Caesarum, which is Latin for the Lives of the Caesars. That work has been translated into English for many years, and we typically refer to it as the 12 Caesars. But in that work, he makes this statement. And if I can translate this loosely, and I've put it on here in advance, an ancient and settled persuasion prevailed throughout the East that the fates had decreed someone to proceed from Judea who should attain universal empire. Here's a pagan Roman historian that's commenting on this perception that a world ruler was going to emerge from this little postage stamp-sized nation of Judea. And then we see Tacitus, who was also a late 1st century, early 2nd century Roman historian and senator. He was a contemporary of Suetonius, a little bit older. He wrote two works that survived, the Annals and the Histories. And this quote is from the Annals. Loose translation is, "It was contained in the ancient books of their priests that at that time the East should prevail and that someone should proceed from Judea and possess dominion." There's also Old Testament references to a ruler originating from Judea. There's the famous star prophecy in Numbers chapter 24, verses 17 to 18. "A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. He will crush the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of all the sons of Sheth. Edom will be conquered." But the key is that first phrase, that a star will come out of Jacob. Origen, early 3rd century Roman theologian, or Christian theologian, said this about this prophecy. "But with respect to the appearance of a star at the birth of Jesus, there is a prophecy of Balaam, recorded by Moses to this effect, 'There shall arise a star out of Jacob, and a man shall rise up out of Israel.'" Origen was referring to this Numbers 24 star prophecy, which was spoken by the prophet Balaam. Then we see in Daniel 9, verse 25, "No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the Messiah, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens." You do the math, and that brings you up to the time of Christ. So there was this perception in the pagan world, as well as among the Jewish people themselves, of a messianic ruler that would be arising at this very time in history. I might point out that the correspondence of these facts will never be the same again. No pagan historian is looking for the emergence of the Messiah prophesied in the Old Testament today. All of the conditions were perfect at the time of the original nativity. Conclusions. There was an expectation of a new king among the Jews and among the Assyrians and Babylonians due to the diaspora, the captivity of the Jewish people following the destruction of Assyria in 721 BC and of Babylon's destruction of Judah 150 years later. And so the point is, many of the scholarly Jews were sent to Assyria and Babylon, and there they were able to communicate with others regarding these prophecies. And furthermore, remember that Abraham himself came from the Chaldees, which is what we would call Babylon. It ultimately became the territory of Babylon and then Mesopotamia. And this explains why the Magi came to Judea, of all places, when they felt that a king was about to be born. Now the next clue, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? And so this is the clue indicating that what prompted the Magi to travel was the birth of the Messiah. We saw his star in the east. This is the fourth clue. They saw his star while they were in the east. Here's the interlinear Greek New Testament again. And these are the key verses, the key words right here. "We have seen for his star in the east." Most scholars interpret that to mean while they were in the east, they saw the star. It's not that they saw a star in the east part of the sky. The exact time the star appeared, Herod called the Magi secretly and found out for them the exact time the star appeared. That's the fifth clue. The star apparently, in this account, appeared suddenly. "Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared." The sixth clue is this. Herod apparently did not see it, at least originally. And then look at these clues. Magi from the east came to Jerusalem. Herod called the Magi secretly and then sent them to Bethlehem After they had heard the king, they went on their way. On coming to the house, they saw the child. What do we see here? The seventh clue. There were long periods of time involved here with gaps. So we see from these verses that there were long periods of time that were separated by gaps of time. This was not a continuous action. And we look here at Mesopotamia, which is probably the area where the Magi originated, somewhere in that region in the Fertile Crescent. And they came down here to Judea. Now, there are two ways to get there, going across the Syrian desert, which is the shortcut, 500 miles. But very few people survived that trip. So almost everybody took the long route up the Euphrates Basin and then down the Mediterranean coast. That about doubled the trip to nearly 1,000 miles, but it was much more likely that you would survive that journey. So we're talking about a trip of almost 1,000 miles that Magi from the east would have traversed to get down to Judea. And what's the point there? It took a long time. The next clue, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. The eighth clue, the star preceded them south to Bethlehem. The star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was in Bethlehem. Now let's look at this map here. If you know your Bible geography, there's Jerusalem and there's Bethlehem. The star they had seen in the east went ahead of them from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. And yet, as we see here from this map, Bethlehem is actually south of Jerusalem by about 6 miles. The point is, stars don't move north to south. They move east to west. This is a very important clue. And the same passage here, the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped. And the ninth clue is that the star stopped over the place where the child was. A very interesting clue. And then there's one additional clue, a tenth clue, which is not really contained in Matthew 2, but we can kind of extract this from other verses. And that is this. We go back to Numbers chapter 4, and it says this in the first three verses. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, take a census of the Kohathite branch of the Levites by their clans and families. Count all the men from 30 to 50 years of age who come to serve in the work in the tent of meeting. That was the age when priests were allowed to function, from ages 30 to 50. At age 50, there was mandatory retirement. There was no age discrimination law. Luke chapter 3, it's interesting, verse 23 says, now Jesus himself was about 30 years old when he began his ministry. So was John the Baptist. They were following in that priestly tradition of beginning priestly ministry at age 30. John 2, verses 19 and 20, Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. The Jews replied, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days? This is one of the most significant verses in the New Testament in dealing with chronology, because we know from pagan historians that this incident occurred at the beginning of Jesus' ministry when he was 30, and that the temple was begun in the year 20 BC. So this incident, because of this reference to it's taken 46 years to build this temple, means that Jesus' ministry had to have begun in the year 26 AD. If Jesus was 30 when he began his ministry, that means he was born in or about 4 BC. Does that correlate with Luke chapter 2? In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Well, we know that Quirinius was governor of Syria for two terms. One was from 6 to 4 BC, and one was from 6 to 9 AD. And so this fits well within the chronology of a birth date for Christ of 4 BC. We also know from recent archaeological discoveries over the last 20 years that Herod died in 4 BC. So all of these facts seem to be supporting a nativity account in 4 BC, plus or minus a year or two. So to recap, here are the 10 clues that we've just extracted from the first nine from Matthew 2, and then the 10th clue on the date from these other verses of Scripture that we've looked at. So now let's go ahead and look at the various explanations which have been cited as the describing what the Star of Bethlehem actually was, and we'll see whether they fit this biblical and historical evidence. These are not in any order, so don't think this, I'm starting with the most commonly cited argument, but this is a fairly commonly cited argument, this first one. And the first explanation for the Star of Bethlehem is that it was a comet. Now, a comet, as many of us know, is simply a large ball, sometimes several miles in diameter. Comet Holmes is only probably 2 miles in diameter. Comet Halley is about 10 miles in diameter. And these are basically giant snowballs consisting of ice, rock, and dust. And as they traverse their orbit around the sun, those with parabolic orbits anyway, and elliptical orbits, actually are periodic, and they go around the sun repeatedly with a very precise period of time. The hyperbolic orbits just pass our way basically once. And you can see in this image the gas tail and the dust tail. Most comets, as they approach the sun, the solar radiation vaporizes the ice and ionizes it, and that's what causes the white tail. And the dust is stripped away as well, and that does not ionize, and it forms just a darker, bluish tail. And the interesting thing about comets is that tail, of course, is always pointed exactly away from the sun. Incidentally, somebody mentioned that we may be able to see two comets shortly. In fact, I just did a check that today there's about 25 comets that are visible right now along the ecliptic. Most of them are 15th, 16th, 18th, 20th magnitude. So, you know, only Dale and I are going to be able to see those. But there's comets all over the place up there. And here's the comet Holmes picture that I took that was in the newspaper. And here we see the typical elliptical orbit of a comet. As it approaches the sun, that's when the radiation from the sun ionizes some of that ice, forms the gas tail, and the dust tail as well. And as the comet comes around in its orbit, that tail is actually preceding it, and that's what strikes people as being so weird. The word comma, of course, comes from a Greek word koma, which means hair, and it's like flowing hair out behind the head of the comet. Now here we see Dante in the seventh circle of hell in his great work, The Divine Comedy. This is the first book, The Inferno. And he is traversing with Virgil there the circles of hell. And he's down at the seventh circle. One of the first people he meets there, he calls the usurer, who turns out to be Reginaldo Scrivegni, who he identifies by name, who was a merchant in Padua, notorious for his corruption. And he had died by the time Dante published his work, but his son was still living, Enrico, and he reads Dante's Inferno, and he sees his father listed as the usurer in hell in the seventh circle. And he's so horrified. He himself had a reputation for corruption, and he begins a life of penance because he didn't want to end up where his father was. And so he engages in many acts of charity, including commissioning a chapel next to his estate in Padua, Italy, that to this day is known as the Arena Chapel because it was built on the site of an ancient Roman arena. Arena, of course, comes from the Latin word for sand. Arena, where the gladiatorial games took place, were covered with sand, and that's where they got their name. But here is the 7-century-old Arena Chapel in Padua, Italy. Now, he didn't want to just build this chapel. He wanted to adorn it with artwork. And so he commissioned the greatest painter of the day, the Italian painter Giotto, to paint a series of dozens of frescoes lining the walls of this chapel. Let me take you inside the front door and show you what it looks like. Each one of these depicting a scene from Scripture. And one of these that you can't really see from this angle is this image right here of the adoration of the Christ child by the Magi. And you see here at the top of the picture the Star of Bethlehem. And what does that appear to be? Looks like a comet, doesn't it? Well, why might that be? Well, it's interesting. It's kind of odd that somebody would depict the Star of Bethlehem in the year 1305 as a comet. But in fact, if we look here at the appearances of Halley's Comet, one of them was in 1301, just a couple of years before Giotto painted his picture. No doubt it was a dramatic object in the evening sky. It's estimated that year probably had a tail occupying 60% of the entire space of the sky, like one-third from the horizon to straight over to the other side. So that was an enormous tail on that comet. What a spectacular apparition that must have been. It had its impact on people, and many suspect that's why Giotto portrayed the Star of Bethlehem as a comet. There are many other interesting appearances of the comet, including one in 1066, just a few months before King Harold of England, the Anglo-Saxon king, was defeated by William the Conqueror in the Norman conquest. And that comet that preceded that Battle of Hastings by a few months was looked at in retrospect as an omen portending the destruction of England, its conquest. Another interesting one, I think the oldest appearance of Halley's Comet for which we have historical evidence that is definite was in November of 164 BC, and I'll return to that here in just a minute. But here, it's interesting, in 1985, the European Space Agency and NASA launched a joint project called the Giotto Probe, named after the painter because of the picture we just saw. Its purpose was nothing less than to examine Halley's Comet during its return in 1986-1987. And here's an artist's depiction of this. Here's one of the photos taken. It came within about 250 miles at its closest approach to the comet. Here's some of the Giotto data. 350 miles, 250 to 350. I think that was actually 350 kilometers from the nucleus. It had a peanut-shaped nucleus that we just saw about 10 miles in diameter, ice-encrusted dust particles, very porous, ejecting about 3 tons of matter every second from 7 jets. The ejecta was 80% water and 10% carbon monoxide. Here's the earliest known reference to Halley's Comet. This is a Babylonian tablet dating to 164 BC. And right on this line, if any of you can read this, it is... Dale and I were going over this before our meeting tonight, and this right here is referring to September 25th to 28th of 164 BC. Of course, it doesn't say 164 BC. If it did, we would know it's a forgery. I tell my fourth grade Sunday school class that they don't understand why that might be. Anyway, here's a picture, an awesome series of pictures of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 in 1994 slamming into Jupiter. And you kind of go from the bottom up and look at this. The comet disintegrated as it approached Jupiter. Gravitational tidal forces ripped it apart, and it ended up in several large chunks that slammed into the surface of the planet. Here's a close-up. I think this was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. It's a fast rotator. Jupiter rotates around its axis once every 10 hours, so it didn't take long for those chunks to have a dispersion across the horizon there. Now, what kind of power was transferred by those chunks of comet? Let me just describe for you the main chunk only, not looking at the other 8 major chunks. There were, I think, 9 altogether, and then many smaller ones. But the largest chunk, let me describe for you the power that it had when it slammed into the surface of Jupiter. The energy of that main piece was the equivalent of a Hiroshima-sized 12-kiloton atomic bomb exploding every second, 24 hours a day, for 175 years. Would we want that chunk hitting us? Unbelievable. One of those bombs was enough. But one every second, 24 hours a day, for 175 years. And that was just the main chunk. Well, let's take a look at the comet explanation and looking at our 10 criteria. Is it a star, a fixed point in the sky? No. Would it cause the Magi to travel to Jerusalem? Well, maybe. Would it herald the birth of a king? Possibly. Would they have seen that comet while they were in the east? Yes, they could have seen a comet in the east. Does a comet appear suddenly? Yes. Would it be possible for Herod not to have seen it? Probably not. Is a comet characterized by long duration with gaps? No. Would it have preceded the Magi south to Bethlehem? I said yes there. That should be no. Would it have stopped at Bethlehem? No. Was there a comet between 6 and 4 BC? Yes. Okay, but on balance, that is really not a likely candidate. So we move on to one final thought here, that comets were viewed as evil omens at the time of Christ. Just as I said, we get our word disaster and disastrous from the Greek word aster or star. And the idea was that catastrophes were associated with these types of celestial events. So let's take a look at candidate number two, and that is a meteor. Well, meteors are just very transitory celestial phenomena. You know, they just streak across the time. Most of you have seen one or more of these, and you blink and you miss them. How many times I've had people in my driveway looking through the telescope, and one person sees a comet or a meteor, but nobody else does. And then they say, where was it? Well, it was right there. And they turn and look, and of course it's gone. So very transitory, very fleeting. Is that the kind of thing that would have caused the Magi to travel 1,000 miles? And obviously not. So would a meteor fit the definition of a star? No, it's not fixed. Would it have brought the Magi to Jerusalem? No. Herald the birth of a king? No. Do you see them while you're in the east? Yes. Do they appear suddenly? Certainly. Would it be true that Herod would not have seen it? Probably, yes. Long duration, because he wasn't looking at the right place in the sky at the right moment. Long duration with gaps? No. How about the star preceded them to Bethlehem? No. Stopped at Bethlehem? No. Did one occur between 6 and 4 BC? Certainly thousands of them did. It's estimated that, 8 billion meteors impact our atmosphere every day. And the vast majority of them are incinerated, of course, and they just waft down to the surface as micrometeorite dust. And that's why when you wash your car, and you leave it in a parking lot for a few hours, and you come back out, the thing is just covered with fine dust. The majority of that dust is micrometeorite dust. It's the remnants of meteors that have incinerated in the upper atmosphere. And then the nova or supernova explanation. Let's take a look at number three, nova. It comes from the Latin word for new. Here's probably one of the better explanations of what's going on here. A nova is just a sudden eruption of a star in brightness, many, many times brighter, over thousands and maybe even millions of times brighter over a fairly short period of time. You start out with a white dwarf star, which is a very compact star, probably not much bigger than our Earth, very dense. It was a much bigger star at one point, but as it used up its nuclear fuel, it started contracting down. There wasn't enough fusion reactions to withstand the inward force of gravity, and it crushes down to the level of the size of the Earth. At that point, the electrons are literally in contact with each other if the star is no more than two or three times as big as our sun initially. And at that point, when the electrons come in contact with each other, if you've studied quantum mechanics, you understand the Pauli exclusionary principle, and it's at this point that the electron orbits come in contact with each other, and they throw up a tremendous resistive force that stops any further contraction. In fact, it is that very force that is why your feet are resting on the floor this evening rather than falling through it, or why I'm standing here rather than sinking through the surface of the Earth. Why you're seated in a chair. It's the Pauli exclusionary principle. It's those electrons will not occupy the same orbit. And that's what keeps elements separate. That's what explains the entire periodic table of elements, is that incredible discovery of Wolfgang Pauli in the 1920s. But we see the same thing in operation here with white dwarf star. It stops the inward contraction. If the star is small enough initially, and that resistive force of those electron orbits repulses any further contraction caused by gravity until this initial star gets up to be, 8, 10, 15 or more times bigger than our sun initially, then the star can actually crush down through that stage and form a neutron star, or if it's big enough, a black hole. But here at the nova stage, the star is not big enough contract down to the neutron or black hole stage. So it stays as a white dwarf. And what happens is if it's in a binary system, here with a red giant star, some of the outer atmosphere of the red giant crosses what's called the Roche lobe, which is the technical term given for it. That's where the gravitational attraction of the white dwarf begins to capture it. And some of that hydrogen and helium gas in the outer atmosphere of that red dwarf accretes to the surface of that white dwarf, and it begins to build up. And at a certain point, the temperature of the white dwarf triggers a very rapid detonation or fusion of that gas, and you see this flash where it increases in brightness thousands of times over the course of just a few days, and you see a star that looks like this suddenly appearing very bright in the sky. Here's an example of a nova. This is a star a few days before could not have even been seen without a large telescope, and now it is one of the brightest objects in the sky, and that is a nova reaction. Now, we see this article in the Astrophysical Journal about light curves. And the fact is that all novae have light curves. That's where they peak in brightness and when they return back to their pre-nova brightness level. And the point is, looking at how many days that takes on average, you're looking at about 50 days. And in fact, astronomers classify novae based on that light curve, generally from 40 to 80 days. But the point is this, it's a relatively short period of time. It's not the months that would have been required to have led the Magi on that 1,000-mile trip around the Syrian desert, up the Fertile Crescent and down the Mediterranean coastline. Well, a supernova is just a humongous nova. It's a little bit different. It's a quite a bit different mechanism as well that triggers these. And here's a very common example. The very first object in the Messier catalog, M1, the Crab Nebula that was formed on the greatest 4th of July celebration in the history of the world, July 4, 1054, when this star erupted. And here's my picture of it. Not quite as good, but, you know, my telescope only cost half that much. Here are the known supernovae in our galaxy. Astronomers estimate we should have 3 or 4 a century. The last one was in 1604. We're 15 or 20 overdue. Some of them may have already happened on the other side of the galaxy beyond the Milky Way that we can't see. We don't know. The year 1006, these are the last known supernovae, 1054, Crab Nebula in Taurus, a daytime object for 23 days. I want you to remember this because I'm going to return to it later. There is no Western, record that describes that supernova. Only in Chinese records is it described. Even though it was a daytime object for 23 days. You don't think that would have gotten somebody's attention? How about this? 1572, there was a 500-year gap. And then we have Tycho's star, Tycho Brahe, discovered in the constellation Cassiopeia. And then just a few years later, we have 1604 Kepler star, supernova in Ophiuchus. That's the last known supernova in our galaxy. Every night, astronomers are discovering these things in other galaxies. And that's a very interesting pastime for amateurs, even. There are many amateurs out there that are engaged in very dedicated searches for supernovae. It was not a daytime object, but it was as bright as Jupiter at night. It occurred, and we'll come back to this in a minute, during a conjunction of Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars, and that's a very important point. Here's a recent supernova in a neighboring galaxy, the Large Magellanic Clouds in 1987. Here is the area of the galaxy a few days before the eruption, and here it was following that eruption. Probably a billion times increase in brightness. Here's the light curve on several known supernovae. But once again, you look at the days here, and you're looking at zero, back down to zero, 40, 50, 60 days is the amount of time. And so these are relatively transitory events, not so much as a meteor, but they are not the several months that would be necessary to get the Magi, like I say, up the Fertile Crescent and down the Mediterranean coast to Judea. So on balance, if we look at our 10 criteria, would a supernova or nova be considered a star in the sense that it's a single fixed object in the heavens? Yes. Would it have led the Magi to Jerusalem? Possibly, yes. Herald the birth of a king? Yes. Would they have seen it while they were in the east? Yes. Would it appear suddenly? Absolutely. Herod did not see it? Unlikely. Long duration with gaps? No. Would it have led them south to Bethlehem? No. Would it have stopped at Bethlehem? No. Was there a nova or supernova in 4, 5, or 6 B.C.? Yes. Chinese records indicate there was a supernova in 5 B.C. But on balance, again, that is just not an adequate explanation. So we come now to what has probably emerged as the most popular theory for or explanation for the Star of Bethlehem, and that's a planetary conjunction. Now, we need to get our definition straight here between an inferior and a superior planet. Many of you know that an inferior planet is one that's closer to the sun than we are. How many of those are there?
Two.
That's right, Mercury and Venus. Superior planets are planets farther from the sun than the Earth. And to the ancients, there were three of them. Those were Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And a conjunction is when two of those three superior planets come into close proximity in the sky. They never really are superimposed one on top of the other. It's a matter of being very close in the sky because they're not coplanar in terms of their orbits around the sun. And so we begin here with Tycho Brahe, the famous Danish astronomer, who spent 20 years on that island of Hven up there examining and charting the skies. This was a pre-telescope astronomer. He died just a few years before Galileo created a telescope and pointed it to the heavens. So he's the kind of the last of the great pre-telescope astronomers. But he is most known for these meticulous charts that he kept of the heavens. He died under mysterious circumstances. It's still being debated what caused that death. But at his death, through a long series of events, his assistant, the brilliant mathematician Johannes Kepler, gets possession of those charts. And over the course of a period of 5 years, literally locking himself in a room studying those charts, he is able to formulate the three laws of planetary motion. What a great intellectual achievement. Isaac Newton, a few decades later, would take especially that third law of planetary motion and adapt it and create a tool that we use to this day, 400 years later, as the major measuring stick for the mass of objects in the universe, including galaxies 10 billion light years away, all based on Kepler's third law of planetary motion as modified by Newton. It's a very simple equation, p squared equals r cubed, but that equation is a phenomenal tool of astronomy. And here's the originator of it. Now, here's what happened in Kepler's case. We see here in December of 1603, he observed a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn right here. This is where these two superior planets came close to each other. That's a fairly common event over the course of 20 years. It happens at least once. That was in December of 1603. But that conjunction was followed by a massing of Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars 10 months later. A massing is where all three of those superior planets come close together. Conjunction is two, massing is three, on October 9th, 1604. So here they are. The night where that happened, the very next day, October the 10th, 1604, right there in the middle of those three planets, he discovers a new star. That was Kepler's star, the last supernova ever detected from planet Earth in our galaxy. He, of course, didn't have any idea what it was, other than it was a spectacular object as bright as Jupiter in the sky, which is the brightest object in the sky other than Sun, Moon, and Venus. Kepler deduces that and this is really a logical formulation. He concludes that a Jupiter-Saturn conjunction followed by a massing of Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars produces a new star. And then he takes those charts of Brahe, and he is able to calculate that a triple, not just a single, but a triple conjunction of Jupiter-Saturn occurred in 7 B.C., followed by a massing of those three superior planets in 6 B.C. Let's take a look at it. This is exactly the way the sky looked in January 7 B.C. We're looking at Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars. Now, here they are coming closer together. We're in February, 7 BC. Now we're in March. And look at our two superior planets here. Of course, Uranus was not visible to the ancients. At least they didn't know it was a planet. Now here's April, 7 BC. Bang. May, 7 BC. Conjunction. Jupiter and Saturn. Now watch what happens here. Here's June, July. Now they're starting to come back together. August, September. Bang. October 3rd, 7 BC. Another conjunction. The second in that year. Through retrograde motion. Here they start separating, November. Bang, December 4th, they're back together again for the third conjunction in 7 BC. Now here's the amazing thing. That triple conjunction was followed by a massing of the planets. Here on December 4th, 7 BC, we don't see Mars in the picture yet. But watch what happens here. In February of 6 BC, Mars does enter the scene and forms a massing with Jupiter and Saturn in Pisces. So Kepler deduces that this triple conjunction and massing produced a new star in 6 BC, just like the conjunction and the massing that he himself had witnessed in 1603 and 1604 produced that new star. And that new star that was formed back in 6 BC was none other than the star of Bethlehem. What a brilliant deduction. Kepler begins a cottage industry of explaining the Christmas star. But was he correct? As great as this theory was, it is completely erroneous. He went to his grave not knowing it. Just like the prospector, they found his skeleton in Nevada. In one hand was a bag full of fool's gold, and in the other hand was a note that he'd scribbled that said, "I died rich." Now let's take a look here at the planetary conjunction. Would that meet our definition of a star? A single fixed star, an Astera? Of course not. Would it have brought the Magi to Jerusalem? Possibly. Herald the birth of a king? Possibly. Would the star have been seen in the east? Yes. Would it have appeared suddenly? No, it takes months and years for these things to develop. Would Herod not have seen it? Highly unlikely. Is it characterized by long duration with gaps? No. Would it have led the Magi southerly to Bethlehem? No. Would it have stopped at Bethlehem? No. Did it occur between 6 and 4 BC? Yes, as we've seen in 6 BC. So on balance, once again, that simply doesn't cut it in terms of the biblical and historic evidence. So planetary conjunction is ruled out also by the use of that noun Astera. Astera, meaning a star. Planetes Astera means a wandering star in Greek. Or we get our word planet. This is the Greek word for wanderer. Wandering or wanderer. Okay, so a wandering star are those planets that move more rapidly than the background stars do. And we see an example of that in the New Testament epistle of Jude. In verse 13, it's only a one-chapter book in the New Testament, so verse 13 of Jude, we see Asteris Planetae, stars wandering, referring here to planets. And that's exactly the terminology that Matthew would have used if he was referring to multiple stars in a conjunction. Well, the sixth explanation of the star of Bethlehem would be that it's a myth. The word myth comes from the Greek mythos, which originally simply meant a story. Now, today, in English, the word myth has many connotations, including, the most commonly, a false story, a story that has no historical basis, but that is used to teach or to instruct or to provide some moral lesson. But that's not the sense in which the word myth is used in biblical studies, which is a scholarly discipline. The word myth does not necessarily connote a story that is false, but rather it describes a story that has a divine component, the intervention of God, or a story dealing with the deity. That is called a myth. It may be historically accurate. It may not be. It's irrelevant. C.S. Lewis once said that the life of Christ is a myth, but it is also a fact. And I think that explains the difference well. But a lot of critics today take the more popular view of myth as meaning a false story with no historical or empirical validation. We see that in the December 2000 issue of Sky and Telescope magazine. Those of you that subscribe to that, right at the top of the masthead there is the article, A Christmas Story, The Star of Bethlehem Explained. Well, do tell. After all these years, somebody's going to tell us what it means. And of all things, who is this? An undergraduate student at Michigan State in physics and math. Give me a break. And so he gives his explanation. Let me just make a few comments about it. I sent a lengthy letter to the editor, and we'll see if it's published. This guy engages in what I believe is a questionable historical analysis, plus several flawed assumptions that are based on what I call an anti-supernaturalistic bias. In other words, here's a guy that doesn't believe miraculous events. Well, if you have problems with that, you got problems with the Christian faith, don't you? It's premised on the miraculous, on a triune God, on the virgin birth, on the birth of the God-man, the Theanthropos, Jesus Christ, the miracles of Christ, the resurrection of Christ. If you have problems with the miraculous, you got problems with Christianity. There's no question about it. But that bias is, I think, really on display in this article. And let me just mention the four, or actually, there's actually five, what I consider to be false assumptions and errors that he makes that I'm gonna comment on. The first one was that the story was written not by a contemporary writer of the event described, but rather by an apologist 100 years or more later, more than a human lifetime after the fact. So he's saying that the Gospel of Matthew is written probably around the year 100 A.D., not by anybody that was familiar with the nativity story. The second point that he makes, he misstates the reign of Quirinius, the year of the census recounted in Luke 2. Many people disputed that there ever was such a census until a bronze plaque was discovered in Turkey that contained the res gestae divi Augusti, which is Latin for the great deeds of Caesar Augustus, of the divine Augustus Caesar, who was the Caesar at the time of the birth of Christ. He dies in 14 AD. And there were ancient references to the fact that he created this list of his greatest accomplishments, and certain fragments of it were actually found, but not the whole thing. Well, when this bronze plaque was discovered, it had virtually the entire res gestae, the great deeds, on it of Divi Augusti, of the divine Caesar. And the ninth one, I just reread it this afternoon, was taking the census. And so, I mean, here again, archaeology just continually validates and corroborates these biblical narratives, and there's a perfect example. And there's three or four other items there. I'm going to take a look at them individually here in this context of this table. We'll look at each assumption that I consider to be flawed and the obvious rebuttal. And the first one, as I said, was that the story was of the nativity scene in Matthew was written not by a contemporary of what actually happened, but by an apologist 100 years, more than a human lifetime, after the fact. So we're looking at about 100 A.D. when the Gospel of Matthew was written. Now, let me just share my own experience. When I was a student at Harvard Law School, it's real close to Harvard Divinity School, just a two-minute walk. And so I decided to take some courses over there. And I took a number of courses at Harvard Divinity School from the chairman of the New Testament Studies Department, Dieter Georgi, who is a German theologian who was here in the United States. And we became good friends. I met with him in his office probably 15 times to discuss theological issues on what little time I had when I wasn't pursuing my legal studies, which were quite arduous. It also developed within me an ability to reason and to use analytical skills of a highly refined nature. I asked him, you know, you keep talking. I took a course from him on the Gospel of Matthew. And many times throughout that semester, he would say, you know, the Gospel of Matthew was written in 80 or 90 or 80 to 100 AD. So finally I said, you know, why do you keep saying that? And he said, well, because I said, what is the basis for that statement? He said, because Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple. And the temple was destroyed in 70 AD by the Roman general Titus. So how could Jesus have predicted it before it happened? You got to be kidding me. That's the only basis? So here is a perfect example of an anti-supernaturalistic bias. He could not believe that Jesus, the God incarnate, could know what was going to happen in 40 years. I don't have a problem with that. Most Orthodox Christians don't have a problem with that, but he had a problem with that. And that's the only flimsy basis for dating Matthew and Elaine. Incidentally, there were 50 students in that class. We had no assigned textbook. Rather, we had like 30 books on reserve in the library with readings that we had to do. And if you, on the last day of class, would look in each of those books, you would see my name 20 or 30 times in each one, having checked that out. Maybe two or three other students in the entire class once. I did my homework. I read that material. I immersed myself in all of the sources and all of the original accounts, the ancient manuscripts. And I came to the radical conclusion, for that class anyway, that the Gospel of Matthew was written by Matthew, probably in about the middle of the first century, about 50 AD. As a result, the dating of Matthew is significant. Because if it happened in 50 AD, which I came to the conclusion that it did, then that's significant because of this, that there were eyewitnesses to the story that were reading Matthew's gospel. How could he put something in there that was obviously fabricated and false? That would have discredited his entire enterprise and the gospel message of salvation that he was trying to communicate. So it's unthinkable that that would have happened. That's why the date becomes very important. And if you're going to pick out one passage and say, because Jesus prophesied the destruction of the temple, that means it couldn't happen. This gospel couldn't have been dated before that happened in 70 AD. You know, you are missing the point as far as I'm concerned. Now, here's the second flawed assumption. He misstates the reign of Quirinius as 6 AD. As we've seen, the historical evidence indicates that he served two terms. One was from 6 to 4 BC, and a census was associated with that, as well as a second term between 6 and 9 AD. He makes a big point in this article about Mithra was born under several of these same circumstances. Miraculous stars, magi, shepherds, a virgin birth. You see, that's the Mithraism, the secret cultic religion. And in fact, those characteristics were associated with Mithraism. But the author of this article doesn't point out that Christianity preceded Mithraism. And you have polemics written in the second century by theologians such as Justin, who rail against Mithraism for lifting whole cloth doctrines right out of Christianity and inserting them in their religion, such as miraculous stars, magi, shepherds, and the virgin birth. That's where these came from. It wasn't Christianity borrowing them from Mithraism. It was the other way around. That can easily be validated by the historical record. The author of that article didn't take the time to do his homework. He makes this statement. All of this has caused critical scholars for the last century and a half to consider the star to lack historical merit. Today's authors proposing an astronomical star are two centuries behind in biblical scholarship. Well, the rebuttal, he ignores the conclusions of the leading theologians of today who are orthodox and accept the possibility of the supernatural. And fifthly, he says there's no other historical references to the Star of Bethlehem, so it must have never happened. Well, again, we've answered that point already tonight when I noted that the supernova of 1054, July the 4th, a daytime object for 29 days, was not mentioned to our knowledge by a single European. Does that mean it never happened? Obviously not. Some disagree with me, and that's fine. But that's all part of the fun of exploration, is looking at the evidence and coming up with your own informed decision. Now, let me conclude with this last possibility, and that's that the Star of Bethlehem was what the Bible, I believe, is actually describing, and that is a miraculous apparition. To our knowledge, one of the first to actually come up with this conclusion was John Chrysostom of Antioch, writing about the year 400 AD. He was a contemporary of Augustine. He believed that the star was a miraculous apparition. Here's a direct quotation. How then, tell me, did the star point out a spot so confined, just the space of a manger and shed, unless it left that height and came down and stood over the very head of the young child And at this, the evangelist was hinting when he said, "Lo, the star went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was." So if you look at a miraculous explanation, that is, it certainly is consistent with each of these 10 clues that we've looked at this evening, which makes me conclude that that is the best theory in terms of the biblical references and the historical evidence. The concept, think of it this way, of a miraculous light that was visible to only a few people. I think of the Shekinah glory that's mentioned several times throughout the Old Testament. Comes from a Hebrew word that means habitation or dwelling. And this was referring to those relatively few experiences in the Old Testament where God's presence dwelled among human flesh, and we beheld his glory as the Shekinah glory of God, usually associated with light. We see it in Exodus chapter 40. "Then the cloud covered the tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord filled it. And Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle because the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." Here's an artist's depiction of that pillar of fire by night that guided the Israelites in their wandering through the desert following the Exodus. Now, it's interesting to compare the Star of Bethlehem account in Matthew 2, which talks about the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped. So here's a mobile event. It goes ahead of them, it guides them, and then it stops. Compare that to the Shekinah glory of Exodus and of the Old Testament. In Nehemiah 9, verses 19 to 20, we read, "By day, the pillar of cloud did not cease to guide them on their path, nor did the pillar of fire by night to shine on the way they were to take." Or how about Deuteronomy 31, verse 15? "Then the Lord appeared at the tent in a pillar of cloud, and the cloud stood over the entrance to the tent." Stood over the entrance. And then Exodus 14. "The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen." And the angel of God, who had been going before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood. So here it is, moving before them and stood behind them. Went ahead of them, stopped over the place where they were. Very similar descriptions. We see the Shekinah glory described in the book of Acts in the New Testament description of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus. The great light from heaven shone down on him. Was that recorded by European chroniclers or Chinese? No. It was a very limited experience. Only a few people saw it. Saul and those people that were with him in his small entourage. When Jesus appears to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Could that explain the Star of Bethlehem? A glimpse of the Shekinah glory that was visible to only those people that God intended for it to be seen by. Those who accept the miracle of the incarnation have no problem believing that another miracle in the heavens guided the Magi to Bethlehem. Let me conclude with this thought. Light that we see in this room, outside, the stars, all light is a form of electromagnetic radiation. There are many different kinds of electromagnetic radiation besides visible light that we can see, but they're all described by two functions, their frequency and their wavelength. How far the wave peaks are from one to the next, from one crest to the next, and how quickly those crests pass by the same point. That's their frequency. So any type of electromagnetic radiation can be described by its frequency and its wavelength. But if you multiply frequency times wavelength for all types of radiation, it is always the same. It is the speed of light. Now, here are some of the major types of radiation. You have gamma ray, X-ray, ultraviolet, infrared, microwave, VHF, UHF, shortwave radio, long-range radio. Now, the interesting thing is this. Visible light is just a tiny sliver of this spectrum. I've exaggerated it here just so we can see where it falls. It's between ultraviolet and infrared. But let me zero in on this a little bit more to just to describe how little we actually see. If you take a ream of paper, 500 sheets, 2 inches thick, and you pull out one sheet, that's about 4/1000th of an inch thick, or 1/10000th of a meter thick. Okay, one sheet of paper thickness. One sheet is 100 times thicker than the wavelengths of visible light. The longest radio wave has a wavelength of 19 million miles. That's the longest wavelength for all forms of radiation. Our eyes can only see wavelengths in comparison, 1/100th the width of a piece of paper, in a spectrum millions of miles wide. What you're seeing right now are forms of radiation, visible light, that all of those wavelengths can be compressed within 1/100th of the width of a piece of paper. So the bottom line is this. We only see this fraction of the entire spectrum, about 1/4000th. I had this neat video showing you the Spitzer Orbiting Space Telescope that's infrared, showing you what the universe looks like through the infrared telescope, how dramatically different things look than in visible light. Okay, here we go. This is visible light, Spitzer telescope. Here is turning on the infrared telescope, and this is what the universe looks like. How completely different. We see 1/4000th of the entire electromagnetic spectrum. I often think of 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 15 through 17 in the Old Testament. When the servant of the man of God, Elisha, got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. "My Lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "O Lord, open his eyes so he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Visible light, Spitzer radio space, the Spitzer orbiting infrared space telescope. There it's showing the universe in infrared. How incredibly different it is. Could that explain the Star of Bethlehem? Light visible only to a few, coming from God himself. Just a little bit more of that electromagnetic spectrum than our human eye is normally able to behold. Could that be an explanation for the Star of Bethlehem? Well, the great thing about this feature of the Nativity story is that each one of us has the privilege to study the evidence and come to our own conclusions. And I just hope that these comments will be helpful to you and make enjoyment of the Christmas season the best ever this year. So thank you very much. And Dale, I'll be glad to take some questions now if you would like.